Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about a model that has been developed from the Head-Off Environmental Asthma Louisiana Phase 2 project. The model is based on the rich experiences of the community health workers that work on the project, in their tenure as community health workers, as well as their experiences before coming to the project. Okay. So to start, we have no financial relationships to disclose at this time. So today, I'm going to touch briefly on the project. I'm not going to focus too much on exactly on HEAL, because really it's about the community health workers and their experiences. I'm going to also talk about the state of health care in New Orleans, pre and post Katrina, the community health worker workforce in response to Katrina, the development of the model, as well as some future directions on where we see the model going in the future. So the Head-Off Environmental Asthma Louisiana Phase 2 project is a children's asthma study funded by the Merck Childhood Asthma Network. Currently, it's a collaborative effort between the Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities Research Education at Xavier University of Louisiana, Daughters of Charity Services of New Orleans, as well as the Children's Health Fund. Asthma educators and community health workers work with families to identify and address barriers to care, as well as develop strategies and that promotes effective self-management skills. And the patients and the families that they are currently working with are families that are patients of the Daughters of Charity clinics in New Orleans, Louisiana. Specifically, the community health workers assist the caregivers in locating and accessing health and social services. So a little bit about New Orleans. So I'm not going to rehash Katrina. I'm not going to go back 6 years and talk about it too much in depth, because really, like I said, today is about taking lessons learned and applying them to a model that can be used in the future. But before Katrina, 2004, New Orleans had approximately 450,000 residents. There were 9 acute care hospitals that were inpatient and outpatient, and 40% of Orleans residents relied on the charity hospital system. The charity hospital system consisted of 2 hospitals, University Hospital and Charity Hospital. And when I say 40% relied on this system, that's not only for medical and clinical care, we're also talking about social services and mental health services. This and then Charity, which is the hospital in the top, the picture in the top, this picture was actually taken 12 days before the storm hit. And this hospital, what it meant to Orleans residents, like I said, this is their hub. They knew where to go. This is where they went for social services, mental health services, clinical services. And as one of our community health workers will tell you, she'll say, even if I could go to Charity and the services that I needed weren't there, someone there knew. And this is where everyone knew, this is where you'd go in the city. Okay. So 2006. Several months after the storm, New Orleans, 200,000 residents had returned to the city. 80% of the Orleans hospitals and clinics were now closed. And in total, this is approximately a loss of 4,400 healthcare professionals to the Gulf Coast. Healthcare professionals is not including nurses. It's including physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and pharmacists. So what are we looking like now? Currently, the Charity Hospital is still closed. I believe that the city is still trying to figure out what's going to happen with our charity hospital system. But these are several of the hospitals. I don't know if you remember a few slides back, there was a really pretty Methodist hospital. This is Methodist Hospital of New Orleans East, as well as Lindy Boggs at the bottom, and then Charity Hospital, current day, which is still closed. So to talk a little bit about community health workers and their response to the storm. Community health workers, and specifically our community health workers, will tell you they returned to New Orleans in the immediate years following Katrina to rebuild and repair their homes, to locate their family, get their kids re-enrolled in school, help their neighborhoods, and to find employment. And actually, the photos that we have here are actually from one of our community health workers, Ms. Alfreda Porter. She said, put my pictures up there. She wanted people to see. You know, she came back, and she's working with families, and this is what she's going home to, you know, and having to deal with. So, this is just a little bit of the experience of our community health workers. So in the city, 2006, there's this large influx of community-based, nonprofit, faith-based organizations that all had missions in recovery. There was approximately $3.27 billion that were raised for recovery efforts and sent to these organizations. But just to kind of put that in perspective, there was almost $220 billion worth of damage done to the city. So it just kind of gives you an idea of how $3.27 billion fits. But the community health workers were really important to these organizations. You know, they were really considered the front line of recovery for the organizations, and also they were able to gain a large amount of knowledge very quickly working for organizations, as well as having to use some of these services and go find services themselves right after the storm. So we sit down with our community health workers, Ms. Porter and Ms. Dixon, and we're talking about what do you want to do? What do you want? How do you want to take those experiences and everything that you went through and turn it into something usable that community health workers across the world basically can really use in a post-disaster setting? So we start by asking, you know, what are the things that you felt your organization or your administrators, how can they support you? What are the things you need for support? So the first item is leadership buy-in. They really communicated that, hey, we need our bosses, our administrators, our supervisors to value what we do and understand the value and the added value of having us employed. There's also training. Sometimes in post-disaster settings, you think things really should be fast-paced. But it's important not to give up the quality of your project and not give up quality of your program by rushing through training or foregoing or bypassing training. So that's really important as well as incentives. This is actually interesting. I was having a discussion with a colleague recently about incentives, and they were saying, well, community health workers, you know, they're really these pioneers and they love their communities. And, you know, do you have to pay community health workers? If you ask our community health workers, they will tell you yes. No question about it, especially in the area that's been affected. You know, they're going through financial instability, just like the clients they're working with are going through. You know, so you have to be willing to pay your community health workers. So the next step, you're talking to our community health workers and we're saying, hey, what are the things that you felt made, you know, that helped you become successful? What are those competencies for success that you feel really made you, you know, helped you have impact the families you were working with? So the first is just basic, it's understanding the needs of the community. I think that applies to most community health workers' work. The second is the ability to communicate effectively with peers and elicit open discussion. In our project, the community health workers would come out with asthma educators and sit and talk to the families, and sometimes you needed the community health worker there to open up the relationship and to get that relationship going, you know, to really bring the asthma educator into it. So that's really important as well. Experience use of services being recommended, as well as knowledge of and access to up-to-date social and health service resources. Very critical in a post-disaster region. In New Orleans, you know, like I said, everyone knew to go to Charity Hospital, or everyone knew to go to City Hall, or go to these different organizations or institutions for whatever services they needed. Well, imagine all of that one day is gone, or closed, or boarded up. So the community health workers really were kind of like the pioneers going back into the city, figuring all this out so they can help their neighborhoods and help their peers. Understanding how psychosocial stress can affect health. This is something that's really critical, and our community health workers were, this is something that they'll tell you they've learned more about by working on the project. Understanding that you can't tell Ms. Smith or Ms. Jones if she's not having her basic needs met, doesn't have food, you know, no access to clothing or furniture, no running water, you can't tell her about how important it is to go fill her diabetes medication. It's about making sure those basic needs are met so the family is better positioned to focus on their health. The ability to interact with other members of the organization and healthcare team, as well as the ability to balance own life stresses with the needs of their clients. In the picture from Ms. Porter, the picture is from her home, pretty much says it all there about making sure that you can deal with whatever you have to deal with at home and still bring something to the families that you're working with. So to develop the model, we look to health behavior change theory. The first is the social learning theory. The social learning theory says that individuals can learn behaviors through observation and modeling. Also that one's cognition is a determinant of behavior. Self-regulation occurs as a result of these cognitive factors. And improvements in self-efficacy can be made through observation. Mm-hmm. So we decided to include empowerment theory, and I'm going to explain a little bit why. A lot of times in these health behavior change programs, we talk about self-efficacy. However, in the literature, you really look around and you see that self-efficacy is a state of being, doesn't necessarily always mean action. So we can improve self-efficacy and improve confidence in one's skills. However, what does that do? So this model actually goes a step further, and we're talking about how does self-efficacy promote action towards behavior, as well as is that behavior sustainable over time, and does it improve quality of life? So here's the model. It's a little colorful. So what we've done here is we've taken the theory and the constructs from social learning theory and aligned different parts of the model, as well as looked at empowerment theory and looked at the outcomes that we want. So when a community health worker comes to a family, is working with a family, we say, hey, you have to first establish rapport, and not just establish, but you have to maintain it throughout the relationship you're gonna develop. You also need to identify voids in care through a needs assessment. Depending on your resources, this needs assessment can be something very standardized, or it can be interviews. It can be just, hey, sitting down and talking, which sometimes is more effective. The next is to model the desired actions or behavior, and this is not necessarily physical modeling. When you look at observational learning through the social learning theory, there's something called vicarious learning, where basically it's saying, hey, you can just tell someone a story and tell them how to do something and tell them, hey, this is what I did to access Medicaid. This is what I did to access WIC. So that modeling in itself has been shown to be to have an impact. You can assist the client then in identifying goals as well as map pathways to success. And this is where we're talking about the self-efficacy piece. Really to having the family say, hey, okay, I understand that, you know, this is what you may have done. You know, you may have had to get your son enrolled in school. I need to have my kids enrolled as well. These are the steps you take, so this is what I'm gonna do next. Next is the desired action is performed. And hopefully, once this self-efficacy is improved or increased, you'll start seeing this sustained behavior change over time. They're taking the lead. The families are really taking charge of their own care. And overall, we hope that this improves the quality of life of the client and the family. So, some future directions of the model. Basically, we want to know, is it effective? We had that large evaluation arrow on the side of the model, and basically, we want to say, can you apply measurable factors to the model and determine whether or not those measurable factors predict one another, and do they ultimately lead to behavior change and ultimately improved quality of life? Is the model generalizable? Very important. We don't wish a disaster in any community, of course. However, we want to know, can the model be applied to other regions affected by natural disaster? As well as, are there settings outside of post-disaster environments where the model may prove beneficial? So in closing, the model provides a framework that will guide community health workers as they work with families that need assistance navigating a remodeled social and health service system. The model probes the community health worker's influence on the family's process of adopting and sustaining health-seeking behaviors. Furthermore, the model predicts that the adoption of said behaviors will not only impact but improve the family's quality of life. Today I'd just like to thank Xavier University of Louisiana's College of Pharmacy, Center for Minority Health, Health Disparities Research Education, Head Off Environmental Asthma in Louisiana Phase 2 Project, the Merck Childhood Asthma Network, as well as Louisiana State University Health Science Center School of Public Health. And that's all.